This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. If you read much politics news, you're probably familiar with the name David French. He is a staff writer for the National Review. He's been a prominent conservative voice. He has now founded a site called TheDispatch.com. And David, I called you because of your latest newsletter where, well, you talked about a lot. Probably my favorite dystopian movie, Idiocracy. I'll refer people to the Wikipedia entry if you want to know what it is if you haven't seen it. But what point were you trying to make there?
I was trying to argue that some of the defenses of the president in the impeachment battle aren't just deceptive. They're actually creating cultural illiteracy and constitutional illiteracy. They're intentionally dumbing down the American public. And one of the examples of that is this claim that, for example, Donald Trump in the House impeachment process has a Sixth Amendment right to confront the whistleblower, to confront this particular accuser. And that's just plainly, completely, totally false. The Sixth Amendment right to confrontation is a right of confrontation in a criminal case. This isn't even a civil court case. It's a political proceeding in the House. Now, that's not to say that the process shouldn't be fair, but to cite the Sixth Amendment is just constitutional illiteracy. Or, for example, every single time you hear a Republican or Republican commentator say the word coup to describe impeachment, well, a coup is an unlawful, often violent overthrow of a government. That's the definition of a coup. Impeachment is a constitutional process outlined by the founders of our country. Now, you may object to impeachment. You may oppose impeachment. But to call it a coup is to just be deceptive. And so if people believe these things, especially, and they're especially prone to believe them because some of this commentary is coming from Republicans and conservatives with very, very, very impressive credentials. So why wouldn't you believe them? Then you're going to be led to believe that what's happening is that the House Democrats are violating Trump's constitutional rights outlined in the Bill of Rights for the sake of an unlawful attempt to reverse an election. And rather than the House Democrats are engaged in a constitutional process, according to the founding documents of our country, that you can support or oppose, but can only be enacted through first a majority in the House and then a supermajority in the Senate of people who won their own constitutionally ordered elections. So this is a constitutional process you can support or oppose. There's nothing unlawful or unconstitutional about it.
Now, I think we've all become familiar with the divisions on the Democratic side. We're seeing it play out in the primary campaign. On the Republican slash conservative side, you have come in for considerable abuse and even threats from Trump supporters. Why?
Well, you know, it's really a sad story, to be honest. I mean, it started in 2015 and 2016 when members of the alt-right, very explicitly white nationalist, white supremacist fringe movement, targeted my family because we opposed Donald Trump, because my wife and I opposed Donald Trump, and very specifically because our family is biracial. My youngest daughter is adopted from Africa. And they very grotesquely targeted her for race. They put her image on Twitter, photoshopping her face into gas chambers with Donald Trump in an SS uniform, pushing the button to kill her, photoshopped her into slave fields, filled my wife's blog with images of dead and dying African Americans. And it actually got worse from there for a while. And I'm not unique in receiving these attacks. Many, many journalists or activists who oppose Trump on the right can tell similar stories. But it was a coordinated campaign of threats and intimidation that hasn't entirely gone away, quite frankly, since Trump's election.
Why do they feel the need to defend Trump? He has seemed to have waffled in the past, but he has come out and said, I condemn white supremacy, I believe, right?
Well, yes, he has. And what's interesting, and you're seeing the newest version of the alt-right, sort of alt-right 3.0, is now going after Trump. One of Don Jr.'s events was interrupted by hecklers.
I saw that.
And these were alt-right hecklers. So when he explicitly condemned the alt-right. He got also got rid of Steve Bannon. And so some of these new version alt-righters are angry at the Trump administration, in addition to being, you know, angry at so-called establishment Republicans as well.
Is anybody trying to take control here? And because I know there are Republicans who I'm acquainted with, I guess you'd call them moderates now, who think the party needs to get control of itself. Is anybody trying to do that in a real way?
Well, you know, it's very difficult because Trump's hold on the GOP rank and file is very strong. And, you know, one of the things that I think that I have found over the last 3 years is that if someone opposes Trump and they're Republican or they're conservative, mm-hmm. they tend not to continue to affiliate with the Republican Party. So Trump will have, say, 95% support or 90% or whatever the number is, very high support from Republicans. And the question is that a growing or shrinking number of people? You know, the fact that Orange County, California used to be a bastion, a GOP bastion, now doesn't have a single Republican representative, is a symbol that, in particular in the suburbs, an awful lot of people seem to be switching parties.
So do you believe, I know there's some question over whether the New York Times head-to-head polls, which seem to show Democrats, most of the Democrats winning against Trump, do you believe those polls?
I believe those polls for now. I would say, as of right now, if you're looking at just real election results from 2017, 2018, 2019, the state of play is that Trump has solidified his hold over rural and exurban America. Like he has a hold on rural and exurban America that perhaps no other GOP candidate has ever had. But at the same time, his hold over the suburban America has slipped considerably. And so it's just a numbers game at this point. You could turn out rural and exurban America to record levels, and it would not be enough numbers to counteract the loss of urban, which has long been gone to Republicans, and suburban America. It's just the numbers aren't there. So if Trump continues to lose ground in the suburbs, he will lose the election. And the Democrats' challenge is to not nominate anyone who would threaten their current hold over the suburban voter. And that's where, you know, a lot of people look at the Democrats and say, why would you nominate somebody who would pledge to do away with the very health insurance that dominates in suburban America and that suburban Americans are largely pretty happy with?
Yeah. David French, one time staff writer for the National Review and founder of thedispatch.com, a prominent conservative voice, I think most people would agree. David, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Quick impeachment hearing update. Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman, dressed in full uniform, said he found the July 25th call, the famous phone call, quote, improper. He was also especially passionate when he said that the character attacks on the others who have testified are, quote, reprehensible. We'll continue monitoring the hearing. Let's now turn our attention to Snohomish County, which has elected a new tough-on-crime sheriff. And now, since the election, there are questions about whether that new sheriff should retain control of the jail when he takes over. Here's Sky Radio's Hannah Scott.
So, Dave, we've talked a lot about Snohomish County and its various programs to take on homelessness and the opioid crisis, from their embedded social worker programs, offering treatment with Suboxone in the jail, their new diversion center, and a whole lot more. Sheriff Tri Trenary and the county executive, Dave Summers, had spearheaded many of those efforts over the last several years. Trenary, of course, lost his reelection bid to longtime patrol sergeant Adam Fortney in this past election. And during the campaign, Fortney made clear he favored this tough-on-crime approach and was also very critical of the policy at the jail of turning away low-level offenders who were high. He never said, though, that he planned to dismantle all of the various social service programs that we just talked about. Still, Executive Summers has some concerns.
All those programs have really been built over the last couple of years, and some of the, I guess, rhetoric during the campaign just caused me great concern that whether those programs will continue or not. Now, I did meet with Sheriff-elect Fortney on Friday, and we had a good conversation. He assured me he wants to or intends on continuing a number of those programs, but we've only had one conversation, so I think we obviously have a lot more that we need to work on together.
So all of this turned into this big kind of controversy over the weekend with rumors starting to swirl after that Friday meeting between the two on social media about Executive Summers trying to snatch control of the jail away from the sheriff's office, mm-hmm. going to the county council with a proposal asking for that to happen, saying that he was planning to do that. So Adam Fortney went to social media saying he was seeing that and criticizing the executive for trying to kind of do an end run around the election results. Dave Summers went on social media and said, you know, this is something I've been in discussions about for a long time, way before the election. And then the unions got involved. It was a big deal. So yesterday was that county council meeting. A bunch of us media showed up. There were union members, Adam Fortney, and some sheriff's officers there to speak out against the plan, but there was no official proposal. In the end, Dave Summers tells me that, yes, it is something that he has been talking about. First of all, a decade ago, the control of the jail was under the county executive's office. It was later switched over to the sheriff's office. So it's something he's thinking about, but he did make clear to me that while it is something he was discussing prior to this election, the results of this election are a reason to look at it more, he thinks, now, because he has got some concerns based on some of the rhetoric he heard during the election campaign that Fortney may not keep some of those programs. So I asked Adam Fortney yesterday after that meeting what he would want to do, whether he wanted to move this back to whether he wanted to undo some of those programs. And he basically said he doesn't want to dismantle anything on day one. He said that he wants to make sure things are working, though. He was noncommittal about what he wanted to do with the jail.
Well, it's apparent to me that the voters wanted to make a change, right? That's why they voted for him. And presumably that change extends to some of the programs in the jail, right? I'm not familiar with the campaign. I know you live up there. So was that a big issue in the campaign?
The jail was absolutely a central issue in the campaign. And that is what Adam Fortney will tell you it wasn't his intention for that to be the case, but it did end up being the case. Specifically, that policy of turning away the low-level offenders who were high on drugs. There's a lot of backstory to that, though. There were a lot of deaths in the jail and there had to be a change. Again, Adam Fortney admits that needed to happen back then, doesn't necessarily think it needs to be the case now, but he has not come out and said that he would change all of that from the get-go. So yes, there's definitely an appetite for change based on the election results, and he won by, you know, I think a double-digit margin. But there's a lot of work that's gone into doing it the other way in Snohomish County. So there's...
Well, just this one thing you mentioned in the story, turning away low-level offenders who are high on drugs. So this is somebody who is arrested and is completely out of it. And instead of jailing them, they just drop him back on the street?
They don't accept them when a deputy...
Well, where does the guy go then?
The deputies, I believe, are supposed to, or whatever law enforcement agency, because other law enforcement brings them to the jail. I believe what Sheriff Trenary told me was they're supposed to take them back to wherever it was they were. So, and we're talking misdemeanors, you know, shoplifting.
Well, I'm talking about that. I'm talking level of just a safety level, right? So when this is funny because yesterday I did a sort of I sat at the bench with a judge in Federal Way, David Larson. And at the end of the hearing, after everybody had gone, a guy shows up in the courtroom and just sits down and passes out. I mean, he's on something. And the judge himself goes to the guy and says, you know, are you okay? Tries to get his name, tries to look him up. Apparently he was due to appear. He got the date wrong. He was due to appear like a week from 2 weeks from then. But he wasn't going to let the guy. He wasn't going to just send the guy out into the street. They called the medics and they took him to a hospital because there was no way he was even in any shape to take a bus back home, certainly not to drive. So I'm just saying if somebody who is out of it shows up at some official facility, you can't just let them go.
No, and I see what you're saying. And it's not necessarily that they were, you know, falling down high. It's if they were high at all. And the reason for that is the Snohomish County Jail's regular medical unit was so 150% over capacity because everybody was going to go through withdrawals, right? I mean, if you go to jail, you don't get your drugs anymore.
Right.
That was the issue. So certainly there was discretion if there was somebody who was falling down and maybe looking like they're going to OD. I'm sure that whatever law enforcement agency would have taken them to the ER or something of that effect. They weren't going in the jail, though.
Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Choke Points.
Let's go.
Is brought to you by Toyota of Puyallup. Remember the plans for that new I-5 bridge over the Columbia River that was going to connect Vancouver, that was going to replace the old one connecting Vancouver and Portland? Well, it is back on the table 6 years after Washington scrapped the idea. And Chris, how serious is this?
This is about as serious as we've seen. The most collaboration, we had both governors of Washington and Oregon sitting down yesterday and signing a memorandum saying, we are going to go forward with this. There is no other option. It is going to happen. And to kind of set the stage for it, this bridge takes about 135,000 vehicles a day, and it can't handle that right now. It is a, if you've ever driven over it, it's thin. I drove over it again over the weekend.
Does it ever open, by the way?
Oh, yeah, it opens all the time because it's still a drawbridge for maritime traffic. The original span was built in 1917. The span next to it was added in 1958. And as I said, both still have to open for the Columbia River maritime traffic. It no longer serves the needs of commuters or the freight that needs to get between Washington and Oregon.
We believe that this bridge is important to the economies, not just of two counties, but two states. This is an absolute arterial for the economies and lives of the entire state of Washington and Oregon.
For a little bit of a history lesson here, the replacement bridge was proposed, granted federal funding, and was really on the fast track to get going in 2011. But the plans were scuttled by Washington senators, including one from Clark County there where Vancouver is. They didn't want to put light rail on the new span because they didn't want to run Portland's light rail across
the
river.
And Oregon was insisting on that.
Yes, and that was it had to be there. There was also some safety concerns about putting the trains on this bridge because this bridge was no longer going to be a drawbridge. It was going to go up and over and had to be high enough to be able to clear all the maritime traffic that would go below it. And so we invested $200 million in it. And that just went away. So did the federal dollars that were promised. So right now, the Governor Inslee says he has no idea how much it would cost to replace the bridge right now. It was about $3 billion in 2011. But the governor says there's no option here.
The first order of bids is to have a bridge that's not going to fall down tomorrow. And so that's got to be the highest priority.
Because it is seismically risky at this point, though the bridge is safe. Oregon Governor Kate Brown agrees that the bridge has served its purpose and it's time to get a new one.
We have to invest in the bedrock of our state's economies, and that's infrastructure. When working properly, infrastructure goes unnoticed, but without it, we're literally in for a bumpy ride.
The only condition set in the paperwork signed by both governors yesterday is that the new bridge must have high-capacity transit. Now, Governor Inslee says that doesn't necessarily mean light rail, which was a big hiccup last time, but light rail would be his first option.
We're not setting preconditions of type of high-capacity systems, and we're going to be driven by data, and there will be a very thorough analysis of the alternatives, and then we'll have a very vigorous discussion in our constituencies to see what their thoughts are.
And while most commuters in Southwest Washington and Northwest Oregon want congestion relief first and foremost, the priority for both governors puts congestion relief last.
Number one priority has to be seismic resilience for this particular project. Secondly, for me, it would include high-capacity public transit. Hopefully, that would move us toward reducing congestion.
So transit comes before congestion relief. So there is expected to be a new fight over what high-capacity transit means. Also, potential plans to toll this new I-5 bridge, which would cause some other set of problems. But Inslee says there's been no decision on that. The tolls would be more of the congestion pricing model based on the time of day, at least according to earlier drafts of the plan. Inslee's hoping that federal funding will go a long way to pay for this project because of the vitality of what this provides for freight, basically between Canada and Mexico, yeah. And through the way. Final report on what they expect this bridge to look like is due in about 13 months, so before the legislative session in 2021.
Don't a lot of people commute from Vancouver to Portland?
A ton.
So why don't they want a rail system?
I don't know. I mean, I've relatives that live down in that Clark County area. They just are tired of the bridge being so. They just want a bridge that works, and they really don't think that they should be spending time worrying about light rail. Or they just want a bridge.
Well, you're going to build light rail eventually, unless we decide to close the West and not allow any more people to come in, and so. You're going to have light rail. So the only question is whether you build it now and make it part of this project and therefore maybe affordable, or you end up having to build a separate one later.
Or you just continue to put, you put high occupancy bus lanes specifically on this as well, and the light rail just ends there at the Oregon side of the water. because the people in Clark County clearly voted down light rail expansions in 1995 and later in, you know, as this project moved through it. So there doesn't seem to be a desire to have light rail go across that bridge and into Clark County right now.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness, and a local one, too. When the call came for turkey donations to Seattle's Union Gospel Mission, one woman felt a call to duty. Cairo 7 TV's Simni Kim has her story.
Navy veteran Heidi McDaniel doesn't believe in lip service.
All these Facebook posts are coming in like, thank you for your service, thank you for your service. And I thought, well, gosh, you want to thank me for my service or anybody else? Give me $10 for a turkey.
Last week on Veterans Day, she posted a picture of herself in uniform, calling for people to put their money where their mouth is. And in just 12 hours, she raised $1,400. But it didn't stop there.
Who gets the turkey check?
She presented Seattle's Union Gospel Mission with a check for $2,000.
Let's look at a nice big butterball turkey.
The money will help the mission meet its goal of 1,200 turkeys by Thanksgiving. Right now, Norm Hummel says the mission is about halfway there.
There's such a joy inside me knowing that there's that amount of people that care.
McDaniel says her dad, a Vietnam vet, is her inspiration.
There's people like him that are homeless on the streets. I just want to feed them.
For McDaniel, it's not about the recognition, but doing what she can to help.
We all did it together. You're welcome.
The turkeys will feed about 1,500 people at all three of its shelters. They'll also be put in food kits for needy families.
Time for the Sports Insider. Stacy Ross from Tom, Jake, and Stacy. Good news about Tyler Lockett. He had what was described basically as a deep bruise, but he's going to be playing on Sunday, Stacy?
That's the hope, that he plays on Sunday. He has to make it through a week of practice, but Pete Carroll otherwise sounded optimistic. Also, let me tell you guys, it feels so weird to join for the sports segment during all of the impeachment stuff. Like, I feel like I'm coming on, but I want to treat it with the same sense of seriousness. So let's also see this as a very serious, you guys need your sports updates. You know what I mean?
It's,
it matters just as much.
This is our little break from the seriousness, though. We want to have some fun outside of the impeachment hearings. So, you know what I didn't realize? So I'm glad Tyler Lockett is doing well. I mean, that's some grit being able to play, possibly, after a big bruise like that. But Luke Wilson, I guess I missed the fact that he exited Monday night's game with a hamstring injury. Owie.
It was kind of a quiet exit. I didn't really realize until there was an announcement that was reported. Usually they do announcements in the press box, and sometimes there are players that you haven't even realized have left the game. Usually it's like if it's a backup or someone that wasn't seeing many snaps, but that sounds, of all the injuries Seattle is dealing with that we know of, obviously they don't have to have a practice report until Wednesday, so there are probably a couple that are going to pop up. But of all the injuries we know of right now, I think Luke Wilson's is probably the most serious, which is such a bummer, not just because he's a fan favorite and everyone likes him, but because they don't really have a lot of depth there at tight end, and so you have yet another person who's going to be out for at least a couple weeks.
Can you explain the whole Colin Kaepernick incident? They were going to have this workout, and then the NFL said, you can't shoot video, and Kaepernick said, but I want to shoot video, so he moves it to a high school football field, and then some of the teams come, but some of them don't. It's just very confusing to me.
Oh my God, Dave, it's a perfect way to explain it. That's exactly what happened.
I think you just became the sports insider, Dave.
You did. Oh, way to replace me. The NFL contacted Colin Kaepernick with relatively short notice, told him, hey, we're going to have a workout for you. This is already kind of a sticky situation because they've settled on a collusion lawsuit. So there's, I don't think there's trust on either side. And there's also kind of, because of that, a vying to not get the upper hand by any means, but trying to, in Colin Kaepernick's case, have as much accountability as possible, because you probably don't trust the NFL at that point. I wouldn't. I mean, yeah, I've sued you before, and so I have no idea what you might think of me. So they schedule this workout. It's supposed to be at the Falcons facility. It's on a Saturday. Colin Kaepernick asks for it to be moved to a Tuesday, which is like the league's Saturday.
Yeah.
He's told no. He's told initially that there can can be cameras there or reporters, or you can record it. And then he's told that won't happen. And so shortly before the start of the workout, he reschedules a workout to about 45 miles away. So of the 27 teams that went to the Falcons facility, 8 of those teams go to the new workout, which is, I think, at like a middle school, at a city out there near Atlanta. And the assumption is that he moved it so that there would be a bit more accountability, so that he could have reporters and he could have a recording of it to send to the teams that couldn't go.
Though.
It did a little bit. And what sucks for him is I empathize and understand. Like, who wouldn't, right? Like, if you sued your employer and then your employer said, okay, well, come on in and let's have you do some kind of tryout, whatever version of a tryout is for your job, but no one can see you, and we're just going to have to tell people how you did. You would question whether or not they'd be honest, and you'd be a little nervous about it. So, but then on the flip side, by moving it last minute, it once again makes it look for teams like it's for show. And so it's not a great look for either side, although I empathize with Colin in that moment. The Seahawks were one of the teams that could have gone, and Pete Carroll said logistically they couldn't make the trip to the new location.
Well, they missed a tremendous 60-yard touchdown pass from what I saw. It looked pretty impressive to me.
It did. I mean, no big deal. Like, I think I could do it.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Our sports insider, Stacey Ross. Thank you, Stacey.
Thanks, guys.
Let's take you now live to Washington, D.C., and David Farenthold at the Washington Post. David, I'm sure you've been dipping in and out of the hearings this morning, as I have. And there, once again, Jim Jordan is now apparently attempting to get the name of the whistleblower by asking Lieutenant Colonel Vindman how many people he talked to and who they were. So my question for you is, how clear is that whistleblower law? Is it indeed illegal to release the name of a whistleblower?
I think it would be illegal for you or me to do it. I think members of Congress are hoping they can, you know, Congress has pretty wide abilities to say whatever they want on the floor of the House or in-house proceedings. It's called the speech and debate clause. It's really hard to hold them accountable legally for things that they say in the course of congressional speeches. But still, it's funny how much they respect that law. Even these people like Jim Jordan, who clearly are trying to, you know, who believe that naming the whistleblower is somehow key to saving Donald Trump. So you can see here that he's trying to get somebody else to say it. And not have himself say it.
If he is able to either trick, I don't think he's going to trick Vindman into saying it, but if they compel it, can they compel him to say who this other person is?
I don't believe so, no. I mean, right. I think Vindman can, I mean, the punishment would be contempt of Congress in any event, which nobody seems to be afraid of. But no, I don't think they can compel him to say it.
Yeah, and it would have to be the chairman of the committee who would have to hold him in contempt, right? And that's a Democrat.
Yeah, it would be a Democrat-led House.
Unlikely to happen.
On it, so, yes.
So they probably won't get the name. The other thing that has come up here is whether President Trump did tweet, I don't know how to take it, but it made it sound like, oh, yeah, I'll testify maybe in writing or something like that. Do we take that seriously or not?
No. I mean, I think you've seen his behavior. As with most things Trump does, it's not the first time he's done it. And so you saw that with the Mueller investigation. How many times did Trump say, maybe I'll talk to him, I'd like to talk to him, I want to talk to him? And in the end, he didn't. He submitted a bunch of lawyer-written questions. And so I very much doubt that in this case he will subject himself to open questioning about this. He's not somebody who plans ahead. It wouldn't go well if he was subjected to this kind of questioning, but I don't think he'll ever do it.
And then I heard, I think it was a Democrat, I forget who, I'm sorry, floated this idea of, okay, we'll call Hunter Biden to testify if we can also call to testify about getting a job through the influence of your famous dad. If we can also call Ivanka and Eric and Donald Trump to testify to the same thing.
I've heard people say that. I don't think it'll happen. Only the Democrats want that. And I should say, the case of Hunter Biden is really different than Ivanka and Don Jr. and Eric. First of all, Don Jr. and Eric don't have jobs. You know, they are theoretically private citizens working in the private sector. Ivanka does have a job through her father, but it's not. I don't think people would see it in the same way as what allegedly Hunter Biden did, which is seeking, you know, giving one particular interest group an advantage because they hire you and your dad's in power. So I don't think they'll do it anyway, but even if they did, they're not really parallel situations.
Okay, give us the update, because this is your beat, on the attempts to get Donald Trump's tax returns. There are now two court cases, one involving one of the House committees and the other involving New York State.
Yeah, one involving the Manhattan DA. So that those cases are now, the Supreme Court is deciding whether to take them up. So Trump has lost all the way up the chain in the appeals courts. And if the Supreme Court decides not to take these cases, then he would have to turn over his tax returns, or in the case of the Manhattan DA case, his accountants would have to turn over his tax returns. They were subpoenaing a third party. Supreme Court is now, there's a hold on those cases while the Supreme Court decides whether they want to take it. I don't know what they'll do. The law seems to be pretty clear to me, a non-lawyer. If they do take it, you think they would have to rule against Trump. But who knows? He's put two people on there. He's got a conservative majority. Who knows how they'll see it?
Yeah. Now, this does not mean those returns would be disclosed publicly, correct?
No. In both cases, when the House committee might be seeking them, and when the Manhattan DA is seeking them, they have promised to review them in private. You know, Trump obviously fears that they will get out publicly somehow. And, yeah. And in the Manhattan DA case, if the Manhattan DA someday filed charges, you know, filed a court case where he wanted to present these as evidence, he could attach them as exhibits. They could show up in a future trial. But it's not like giving them the Manhattan DA that they would leak out the next day. At least that's what the Manhattan DA says.
Right. But none of my business, unless there's something illegal. Now, as I understand it, through the Al Capone case, as long as you report your illegal activity, the IRS is not going to come after you. Is it possible that we have something like that in a Trump tax return?
Very possible. I mean, the only thing I can tell you about the way Trump's tax returns might look is the tax returns of the Trump Foundation, which I spent a lot of time looking at, and those were full of things that were illegal. Trump just paid a $2 million settlement for them. But they were not, you know, they were either disguised or they were just sort of not flagged. So you had to do a little investigation to figure out what was behind them. So if that's the way he and his accountants approach sort of rectitude in tax returns, then there could be some stuff hidden in Trump's tax returns that could be a problem, but we don't know until we see them.
So you think that he may have accurately reported illegal activity in those tax returns?
No idea. I doubt that. Okay. He would say, like, hey, listen, I did this bad thing, but at least I'm reporting it. What he did with the Trump Foundation was he did things that were against the rules and didn't report them. But who knows?
All right. David Farenthold, live from The Washington Post. Thank you, David.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.